This is why we love racing in all its forms.
Belgian Clare kicks. Belgian Clare's won it for Australia. They're on top of the world.
Bling It On from Colt 31. And Bling It On. The comeback boys done it. Bring It On first.
It's still Rajasthan in front. And Rajasthan wins the Sandown Cup.
For the next hour, RSN is cracking the codes.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, everyone. It's Victoria Derby Day. What a day it's going to be. It's a day where, well, Victoria Racing Club will have no crowd at the Melbourne Cup Carnival, which is going to take a bit of getting used to, but I'm sure the racing is going to be as superior as it always is. Matthew Stewart and Simone Fisher, I suppose we've got used to that COVID type of crowd right through the spring. It's a big deal, but unfortunately it's one we're getting used to. But it's a special day, and it's a special week. There's plenty happening in all three codes. It's a great time of the year. Somewhat the shackles are off from the government this week. We sense things are getting closer back to normality. It might take a few more weeks. It's trickling. It's like a little spring at the start of the mountain, and it's going to end up as one big river, we hope. Good morning to you both.
I hope we don't drown in that river, Dan.
Good morning,
Simone, because you've been out of incarceration for longer than we have, but the first night of it, me, Wine Shop Dave, Mrs. Wine Shop Dave, and a handful of others legally went down to the foreshore at Sandringham in the car park there. And Dave pulled up with his ute and reversed in. We had a barbecue on the back of it, and we all sat around on a table with the sun setting, and we've never felt so happy. You know, everyone was just, and everyone who walked past who, you know, because snooty people live in Sandringham and usually they don't say anything when they walk past. Every single person wanted to tell us, oh, that barbecue smells nice and oh, look at what a wonderful time, and everyone's patting each other's dogs. And so it was just lovely. No one's going to catch coronavirus. No one's going to catch the mange off the dogs from so much dog patting. But Simone, you don't understand because you've been out of the bubble, but we are overcome with joy in here in the bubble.
And I absolutely agree with you, Matt, because we have been allowed that bit of freedom. You know, we can travel. We haven't been restricted to 5 kilometres. And I don't think that we actually appreciate and understand the gravity of the situation that you guys have been in for so long. And it's just those little things that we take for granted that we do week in, week out, that we catch up with friends, have a drink, maybe have a barbecue, particularly coming into this warmer weather. So I think for us, we really don't get it like you guys did. And we perhaps, you know, thought, come on, you people in Melbourne, just stop trying to just play by the rules and it'll all be over. And that was easy for us to say. But to really understand that sense of frustration and devastation for many people, I'm wrapped for you. And I can't wait. I don't know who out of the three of us is going to organise it, but I can't wait till we catch up as well. Will it be me?
Okay. Yeah, it'll be you. Hey, Dan. Yeah, no, I agree with all that. Hey, Dan, what's a purist?
A purist?
Well, you know how Derby Day is the purist's day.
Yep.
Well, there'll be no purists on track today because there's no anyone going on track today, which just on that, it's the full gravity. I mean, we're all feeling joyous and so on, and they're talking about crowds for the Boxing Day test and so on, but it's such a stark reminder that the effect of coronavirus is still with us. That Cup Week, there was 2006, I think 460,000 people went through the gates at Flemington, 460,000 for the 4 days, you know, and they had to cap the crowds in 2006 because too many people were going and all that sort of stuff. And it's got this historical precedent for over 100 years of this mass gathering. And to have no, it's been felt, Dan and Simone, through Moonee Valley and Caulfield, but the full whack of it is Cup Week, isn't it? With all the, you know, the crowds and the lawns and the marquees and all that sort of stuff. So as much as we're joyous about where we're at, it's such a stark reminder starting today of the effects of Corona, but also what a relief it is that the action on the track is so compelling that it gives us, it can jolt us away from the fact that there's no one there.
Well, a purist can be that from home, I suppose. Don't have to be on the track to love your thoroughbred racing or any of the three codes. And we always fall back on that we were still racing, and you know that's probably a bit soft now. I think that everyone was doing the right thing right from the start. Crowds would be back for Melbourne Cup Week. So I think, you know, VRC, I think members, I think some of the punting public that would have been there can have Yeah, they can look back at the government and a couple of decisions that were made there and not made correctly. Otherwise, I reckon we'd be back in a much better position 3 weeks ago and there would have been crowds at some of our best races. But nonetheless, the task at hand is enjoying what will be a fantastic week. And from the Melbourne Cup point of view, guys, this race is shaped as a really good classic Melbourne Cup. There are some years the fields are just better than others, but this year I'm really looking forward to it. You're going to have classic winners in there. I mean, you've got English Derby winner there to start, but you'll have the Cox Plate winner and the Caulfield Cup winner there, plus the reigning Melbourne Cup champion. It's setting up to be the race of the week, which is what it should be, but it's not always that way.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's a good, interesting contrast. It's probably the greatest Melbourne Cup we've ever seen as far as the quality and the internationals, and Danny O'Brien said as such. Not sure the Derby is quite the same story today. I think it's a weak Derby. There's no doubt about that. And one thing that I think Simone is great about Derby Day is that you don't necessarily have to hang your hat on the Derby itself, because quite often it's not the most interesting race of the day, and it certainly isn't today. So there are other races like the Coolmore and the Cantala that are actually far more interesting to me than the actual Derby. But that's neither here nor there. But I'm really looking forward to the coverage today on the digital and so on too. So it's going to be a really busy day, but we're going to really love it. We're going to be on track. I don't even know how to find it. Where is it? It's near Ascot. It's near Footscray, isn't it? Flemington?
It's a big suburb, isn't it? Hey, you had to walk around it. Take her a fair while.
Simone, very sad. You just informed me before our mate Missile. Tell us, this was one of the loveliest stories, but unfortunately the inevitable has happened with Missile. Take us through the Missile story, and then we're going to play a little grab from Mel Tochner out there at the vet clinic at Sandown to tell us a bit more. But tell us about Missile.
Well, Missile was a beautiful story of a greyhound that was adopted. She was 11 years old, and she was someone's pet, and she was diagnosed with terminal cancer back in April this year, and her owner decided that he was going to make a bucket list for Missile, and a couple of those things included a run up the Sandown Strait, which has received worldwide publicity of Missile and her very aged and wonky legs running up the Sandown Strait for the last time. She also ate a birthday cake, and just recently another bucket list target was to run through some puddles. So,
think about that. Isn't that just beautiful?
It's a lovely thought, and it might seem so, a greyhound running through puddles, big deal. But when you think of it in the context of a greyhound who is really knocking on the door of, the end of her life, doing something so simple as that is really quite heartwarming. So the unfortunate news that Missile has passed away in the last week or so, and Mel Tochner contacted me during the week to say that this had happened, but her owner had sent her the videos of Missile running through the puddles, and we spoke to Mel only a couple of weeks ago, and her owner was, the greyhound's owner, was just waiting on some drugs to come from the USA to start some new radical treatment, I think it was, to try and target this cancer and get on top of it. But I think it just showed the aggressive nature of what she had, that no matter what you can throw at her, she just was, succumbed to this terrible disease. So, look, a lovely story and a sad story, but we all know with pets it's inevitable, isn't it? And with people. So it's just trying to prepare for the worst. And she had such a quality of life, Missile, in these last few months, and received very, very positive publicity.
Be curious to know what given the previous story leading up, the funeral will be something to behold, I would imagine. Hey, and this is Mel Tochner out there at the clinic was very close to Missile, and this is just a little snapshot of what Mel had to say about Missile when we spoke to Mel about Missile about 2 or 3 weeks ago.
So he sent me a letter and asked if there was any way we could organise a last run down the strait, especially if the lure was going, because it makes her go crazy. So I checked in with Graham, the head groundsman here, and he checked with Adrian Scott, and we got medical clearance through the Melbourne Animal Cancer Centre, and so we made it happen for her. It's blown up Facebook for us. I mean, we have about 800 followers, and now we've reached over 300,000 people worldwide, and they've all interacted in a positive way with so many comments, shares, likes, Ireland, England, the USA. We're blown away. People contacting us in a positive way. It's been great.
Mel summed it up beautifully there, didn't she, with her snapshot of Missile in that interview we did a couple of weeks ago. But there is plenty happening in the dog world at the moment, and we look forward to the Hume Cup on Monday night, which will be held at the Meadows. It's run over 600 metres. It's had quite a history of different tracks and different distances, but it's worth $75,000 to the winner. It's a Group 1 event. On the same night, we have the RSN Silver Bullet, which is a Group 3 event over the 525. I think $25,000 to the winner there, so some good money going out on Monday night. Tonight at Shepparton, they have the Northern Districts Cup, which is worth $25,000 to the winner. There was a new record at Shepparton during the week over the 385, so we can see that the tracks are really starting to get quick with this warmer weather. It's been the 12-month anniversary since the Greyhounds flew to the USA into new homes there, and hasn't that gone quickly? Perhaps we need an update with Rebecca Miller about those Greyhounds in the USA. I'll try and track one of those down, an interview with her in the next few weeks. And I think that's about it. But talking about the Hume Cup, Fander Bale back in 2016, she took out this event. But Rockoon in 2017, he actually won the race, but it was regarded as the Greyhound Clubs Australia Run of the Year for 2017-18. So let's take a listen to Rockoon winning the Hume Cup in 2017.
Racing Mystery Ride began pretty well on the inside, away fast there. Van Ann going around the outside there. Brugolino towards Lee was swept wide. Mystery Ride led by a length and a half. Raleigh to Khan, five lengths away then. Up to third spot out of the straight is Helen Mike. About two further back in the race there. Brugolino going to the outside. Ricurna starting a run. Spots leader 8 or 10, but finishes well. Then Van Ann followed by Weary out there. And Cardamon at the tail coming off the back. And Raleigh to Khan, the leader. Two lengths in front. Mystery Ride second. Coming home very strongly is a Rocky Raccoon on the outside. Raccoon dashed up, takes lead, and Raccoon came away for an easy win.
And that was Rockoon taking out the Hume Cup. And I did forget to announce the biggest news, that the Top Gun fields for the stayers and the sprinters have been decided. The box draws will be done on Monday night for them as well, and it will be Top Gun night next Saturday night at the Meadows. So we're really getting into this Metro Carnival of racing.
Just on the... You know how I always talk about the biggest genius in greyhound racing is the person who comes up with the names of these races, the Top Gun, the Paws of Thunder and the Silver Bullet. I wonder what the next one's going to be to maintain that elite level of well-named races. I know Harness has
got... The Golden Bark at the Park?
Yes.
The Golden Bark at the Park.
Bark at the Park. I reckon that's great, Dan. You're just trying to get in the coattails of this genius at GRV who keeps coming up with these names. Daniel... I saw our little girl win the other day.
Pink Galahs, she's pretty special, isn't she? And she beat the boys. That was a Heat of the Trotters Derby. And I thought it was a soft win. She was up against an Elite Stride, who ended up running third in the race, who had only been beaten once. He was the boy star, but it's the girl who's the star. And the final of that race is the Victoria Trotters Derby, and that's at Maryborough on Sunday. It's Redwood Classic Day. 12 races, all trotting. It's a wonderful, wonderful race program. Change in the programming this year, obviously through COVID. So the back half, or the last few months of the year, all the feature races and harness racing that would have been run anywhere from March to the end of the year. So it's a pretty good time of the year. Saturday tonight, the feature is a Group 1. It's the Queen of the Pacific. Now, this is for the mares. They don't often... run over 2760, which is a staying trip. But this race last year, I personally thought it created the best race, the most entertaining race of the whole year. And it was won by a little girl by the name of Pistol Abby, not unlike Pink Galahs. So let's take a listen to Pistol Abby's upset win in the Queen of the Pacific last year. And the leader is the favourite, Tell Me Tales, has worked hard in the run. Leads by a metre on Berasari as they start to up the tempo again. Out three wide, pouring on the pressure. Soho, Burning Love, makes every sense is right there. Reciprocity on a loose rein, then my... Harmony Blue, Pistol Abbey's running into it, heading off the back straight though. Tell Me Tales joined by Soho Burning Love. Soho Burning Love put its head in front, then in third makes every sense, and Pistol Abbey getting home. Off
off the back straight in 27.7. Tell Me Tales, Soho Burning Love. Prestolabia around makes every sense. Into the straight, Tell Me Tales, Soho Burning Love. Here comes little Prestolabia. Prestolabia right down the outside with David Moran. And Prestolabia's going to take the group one. Prestolabia wins the Ben Studd Queen of the Pacific. Now that was a race. Second home, Soho Burning Love. Third.
That wasn't a bad call either, Dan. I know you don't like singing your own praises, although we do hear a lot of your own replays, but that's just the way it is. But that was a lovely call, and you summed up the, you know, some races are bigger races than others and more dramatic, and you nailed that one, didn't you?
Look, there was an exciting race. Thing is, with harness racing, it doesn't just always build to that climactic last 50 metres, like a thoroughbred race almost always does. So the most exciting part of race could be at the start, in the middle, or naturally at the end. And this race had it all. They just went flat chat all the way, and it was one of those races that it peaked for 3.5 minutes. It was a really, really entertaining race.
Dan, one thing I noticed with her when she was winning was just her style of running. I don't know if you're able to really pick that up when you're calling because you're probably focused on what the horses are doing, but she just ran with her head down, or trotted with her head down, didn't she? It's like some of the others have got head checks and things to stop them doing that and have their head up in the air, but she just, it's like she just stuck her neck out and went. And I find it interesting, some of the styles of even the gallopers, just the way the horses, they trot. Some have got the really lovely floating extended trot. Some have got a really choppy action. Same with the greyhounds as well. You can see that just their individual styles, sometimes they're all doing the same thing, but in their own way.
It's harder to tell with the greyhounds because the movement's so rapid. You know, you'd probably have to slow it down to notice the actual, unless you had a good eye for it like you do, Simone, and probably Dan. Well, Dan's probably got more of an eye for the greyhound stride as well. But isn't it? It is right too. Like even in Melbourne Cups, when there's 24 horses galloping around, sometimes you look specifically horse to horse, and some have got a head carriage so low that you think they're about to pick the grass, and others, like Very Elegant Dan, have it up and throw it around, and Might and Power is up high and with the reaching action, and there's no set rhythm for a trot or a pace, is there? Like Poppy and Christian Cullen had a completely different action to Gamelite and Paleface Adios, didn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Paleface Adios was always considered a horse that had one of the greatest strides of all time. Even the galloping fraternity used to refer to a thoroughbred that would have a lovely cadence as stepping out like Paleface Adios. It was well known in the 70s and the 80s. And then you get your Christian Cullen come along. And even
Ride High, Ride High had a very supersonic action too, didn't he?
Yeah, with a bit of a turbo when you wanted to press it. But you're right about Prestolabia, the style. She was only little. She was probably marginally bigger than a Pink Galahs, but she'd put her head down. And usually when they put their head down, it's a sign of trying really hard. And that's something that you just can't steal in an animal.
Hey, really looking forward to our two guests this morning. Sam Doran is a guy I really respect because he gets it. He gets the narrative of racing. And we're going to tell us about, Simone texted me during the week and said, why don't we do this? And I looked at I hadn't seen the Kingston doco that he did for racing.com. But then I watched it and it just reinforced support for Sam Doran and the way he goes about things. And we all had a look at it and we all were really impressed, and we're going to have a chat to Sam, aren't we?
Yes, we are, and about a famous chestnut. There's a little bit of a theme of chestnuts this morning as well, and Kingston Rule, probably one of the greatest bred horses that Australia's ever seen by a champion in Secretariat. Maddie, of course, is Equine Love is Secretariat.
I'm so, cracking the codes as Secretariat man.
Oh, I'm glad you said the codes.
I haven't taken Russian Camelot. I thought Russian Camelot was your love child.
Dumped him.
Yeah, there's certainly a Russian connection there. There's no doubt about that. But it would be great to have Sam on this morning to have a chat. And look, he's done some wonderful work. I was lucky enough to be involved in the Calling the Cup last year. And we'll have a chat about the Kingston Rule, a doco, but also what else is coming up on racing.com this year. And Robbie Lang's going to join us too. Robbie, through the latter part of the noughties and then the early tens of this century, gee, Robbie had some success at Flemington with his 2-year-olds and the Derby, Victoria Derby with Polanski, Matt.
Yeah, and it was Good one for me too, because I went down and did a story on Polanski, and Robbie's been a bit of a gypsy trainer. He's never in the same place for long. And at the moment, actually, he's without a license, but I think he's rebuilding towards it. And I went down to one of his the properties that he was at and had a look at Polanski before the 2013 Derby, and you've never seen a horse more carved out of granite than this horse. Just incredible craftsmanship from Robbie Lang to get that horse to where he was. So, and then I backed it. So it's a Derby quite close to my heart.
Always pocket-related, isn't it? But it is a good story, and he was purchased, I think, for about $4,000. So it's a wonderful story to see where he beat the Blue Bloods.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. So before we get Sam on, do we want to throw to one little excerpt to set the scene from that great doco he did? So we might just play this, and then we'll come back with Sam Doran.
I basically said, not word for word, but it was like, hit him like you're going to hit me in the run. In other words, you know, he was trying, but don't hurt him.
And that was Darren Beedman talking about the instructions for the Melbourne Cup on Kingston Rule from Bart Cummings, which Bart was basically saying, you wouldn't hit me, so don't hit Kingston Rule. So anyway. Yeah,
not the other way.
No, not the other way.
You could take it in the other text, couldn't you? But it's be kind.
There was
only
one slightly better quote regarding whipping a horse when Peter Moody said to Luke Nolan about Black Caviar, you hit her, I hit you. So let's take a break, actually. And when we come back, we're going to have a chat to Sam Doran about his doco about the Kingston family.
Loving their racing, pacing and chasing. Matt Stewart, Dan Malicki and Simone Fisher. Cracking the codes.
So the Sunday after Derby Day, I had the trot and canter him. So he's running the Moonee Valley Cup. He's galloped to Breakfast with the Stars. He's galloped on the Thursday morning. He's raced over 2,500 on the Saturday. And I trotted and canted him on the Sunday after Derby Day. And I thought to myself, on Monday morning, I got him ready and I was trotting him around because we used to give him 5-10 minutes trotting and that. And Bart was up in the stand and I thought, this bloke's going to gallop him. I said, he's going to kill him. And I trotted him around and I went up to the hut and he said, what do you think, Joe? I said, oh, I think he's felt the run, Bart. trying to convince Bart not to gallop him. And he just went, he goes, go a mile home 2:27 and look after him. That's the exact words, look after him.
That's an excerpt from a wonderful documentary that I must admit I was really taken with, and I wasn't the only one. It aired on racing.com during the week, and the man responsible for putting that together, that was Joe Agresta, who was the track work writer for Bart Cummings and Kingston Rule in the lead up to that 1990 Melbourne Cup. Sam Doran is the producer from racing.com that put it together, and it was a wonderful piece that we all thoroughly enjoyed, and we wanted to find out a bit more about it, so we thought we'll get Sam on this morning and have an in-depth chat. Sam, thanks for joining us on Cracking the Codes, and firstly, congratulations. That was another wonderful documentary that we've all thoroughly enjoyed.
Thanks, Dan. It's very kind words to say that. I just want to point out before we get rolling on the story that there's a lot of people involved in putting these together. You know, we had two camera guys, two editors. We had great assistance from the team at Godolphin to actually get Darren Beedman as part of the story and Gemma Cutter cutting from Inglis. So, you know, it's my name's on it, but there's a big team of people. But I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Sam, why this particular subject? It's a great one and it was a great doco, but it probably not an automatically walk-up start sort of idea, Kingston Rule. And there was obviously the pedigree and all that. Why the Kingston Rule story?
Well, Matt, it's a really good question. You know, you look back at the history of the Melbourne Cup, and since about 1925, Melbourne Cup times have sort of been pretty much about the same. You know, it's like 3:24, 3:23. Now, depending on track conditions and the like, if you get a heavier track, it's, you know, a lot slower. But there's this outlier with him at 3:16.3. So if you can compare him to Vow and Declare last year, who ran about 3:24, that puts him 150 metres faster, you know, ahead of Bow and Declare, Kingston Rule. So that's a really interesting point. Is he 150 metre better horse than Bow and Declare? Probably not. But that's a really interesting sort of starting point, and that's where I got to initially. And then when you start to dig a little bit deeper with the story, there's all these layers to the story. There's the David Haynes component, who was the breeder of Kingston Rule, who'd gone so close with his great horse, Kingston Town, only 8 years earlier, only to see him run down in the shadows of the post in the Melbourne Cup. And, of course, it's the race that we all want to win. If you've got horses and thoroughbreds, that's the race you want to win. It's a Melbourne Cup. So there's that element. There was the component that Bart Cummings hadn't trained a Melbourne Cup winner since 1979, and we had a younger group of trainers coming through, like Lee Friedman, who trained the previous year's winner, and everybody thought that Bart was yesterday's man, and that, you know, that racing had sort of passed him. So there was that.
And there'd been the drama of Bart's demise with the fire sale and the only a couple of horses in work, and Joe sticking with Bart even though he got other offers. Bart was on his knees, wasn't he?
Absolutely. Like, you know, we go through it in the story for those who haven't seen. I don't want to give too much away, but he spent about 20, between the New Zealand and Australian yearling sales, he spent nearly $28 million. Now, to put that into today's terms, that's close to $100 million in yearlings. That's an enormous amount of money, and it's hard to sort of get your head around. But that was the end of the flying 80s, where there was a lot of business, you know, business became involved because there was all these tax breaks with breeding and racing. So, and Bart got left holding the bag with all this money. So, you know, even after they had a fire sale where he had, you know, $20 million worth of horses went through the English sales ring from New Zealand and Australia, they only got about $11 million. So he was still $9 million in debt. And to make things worse, and this doesn't actually make the story, one of the horses that went through the ring, Tommy Smith bought for $50,000, and I think Bart had paid $120,000 for it in New Zealand, end up being Pharaoh, who won $2 million and two Doncasters. So, you know, Bart, in terms of people being able to compartmentalise and focus on what they were good at, Bart was the great example of that. He had all these things going on and swirling around him, and the one thing that kept him going were the horses. And at one stage, as you point out, Matt, he had three horses in work at Flemington. It's hard to believe.
Sam, it's almost like a Hollywood script, isn't it? You've got this amazingly bred horse. You've got the trainer that I was really surprised to hear about Bart's woes back at that time where he owed all that money. I'd only ever known of Bart as the very witty, clever, amazing horse trainer. You've got the trainer that rejected him. You've got so many different elements to this story that have come out in this Kingston Rule doco. And I was absolutely blown away by it, but it's just such a wonderful story. What other things did you uncover that didn't make the cut?
Oh, well, there's a lot of elements. You know, I think the fact that he'd had a couple of starts, that he was Kingston Rule, went to France to Patrick Biancone and hadn't impressed there, first of all. You know, he'd had a start, and again, it was on a wet track, and, you know, finished down the track, and they didn't think sort of much of him, so they sent him to Australia, and he went to Tommy Smith, and I think famously, I don't know if we've got the grab there, but he had a run for Tommy Smith, and if you can play the grab, it sort of explains what happened there.
And TJ's words I remember to this day. He said quite sternly, "Well, Gay's Gay, and I'm TJ, and I'm telling you the horse needs to go elsewhere, to be removed from the stable."
Have Tommy evicted the horse? And Sam, just again, what Simone was sort of alluding to as well, you know, with the time and, you know, the margin, if you equate the time to previous winners, and it goes back to the sire and the exotic story of the mating of Secretariat and Rosa Kingston, because if you're talking about horses on times winning by huge spaces, there was no more exotic example than Secretariat, was there?
Yeah, that's right. And he didn't prove himself to be as amazing racehorse as he was. He actually didn't prove himself to be a great sire going on. He didn't have that imprint. It's not a lasting imprint. So he was a bit of an outlier in that regard as well. And the fact that David Haynes was such a forward thinker, and we're talking in the middle 80s here, that he was sending horses to America to breed them to Northern Hemisphere time. And we see a lot of that now. Now, Russian Camelot probably being the prime example of late, where, you know, we're trying to breed the best possible horse. And he was doing this 30 years ago. And it's, you know, even with a small amount of horses that he was breeding every year, it was not more than about 12 or 15 a year, because he only had a very small broodmare band. But he had incredible success. I mean, he won so many Group 1s. I think Cathy explains that there's 13 Group 1 winners in about 25 years that won 38 Group 1 races. It's a ridiculously strong strike rate. And plus, you know, there's Group 2s and Group 3 winners there as well. So, you know, that's a really interesting part of the story, the fact that we had a forward thinker a breeder and an owner who's ended up in the Hall of Fame because of what he did. And he wasn't a racing person to begin with, which makes it even more interesting.
Well, golf's connection with thoroughbred racing, usually the jockeys on their day off, walking around and getting low handicaps. But in this instance, the word handicap might pop up because of the Melbourne Cup. But the golf connection was a significant one, Sam, with the forward thinking of David Haynes. He took advice from, someone that was very, very well known in the golf industry.
Indeed. And, became invested in golf and wanted to get his handicap down. And from what I understand of David Haynes, any time he took on a project, he sought out the best people. And Norman Von Neider was a great player himself and then became a golf instructor. So he took lessons from Norman. And one of Norman's other great strengths was breeding and racing. And he had an incredible amount of knowledge in terms of bloodlines, thoroughbred bloodlines. And he was the one who actually encouraged David in the first place. So, you know, he was going to Italy and buying mares, in the middle 70s for David to initially start off his broodmare band. So there's that connection as well. And unfortunately, when you've only got 27 minutes, there's so many things that you would like to put in, but it becomes a difficult process where you've got to sort of filter in at the top and hopefully that the things that you actually put on screen are the most important. But that was a very important aspect, the fact that Norman Von Neider not only got his golf handicap down for David Haynes, but gave him all these great broodmares.
I had was granted an interview via Cathy with David Haynes probably 8 or 9 years ago when I was at the Herald Sun and in his plush, beautiful office in the top of Collins Street, and sat down and we're talking about Kingston Town and all the horses and so on. And he was very modest about his wealth and he said, can you please make sure that you don't bring the wealth part into it too much and, you know, like just concentrate on the horses because I'm a humble man. And the headline in I wrote the story, a big double page feature, and the headline was "The Billionaire Is Back." And I just thought, he's going to hate me. And I said to the editors, please play down the billionaire aspect. And I think he misheard me and said, "The billionaire is back." Hey, but I never heard from David Haynes afterwards, which was probably a good thing. One thing that came out in the doco was the autonomy that Leon and Joe, and I think Nigel might have been there as well, Nigel Blackiston, they ran the show a bit, didn't they? Like Bart would make cameos and there'd be the odd phone call, but a lot of the credit for these horses had to really go to the Melbourne crew, didn't it? Including Kingston Rule?
Absolutely. They were the ones who got him going. And Bart wasn't coming to Melbourne. His stables, the head of, his major stable was in Sydney and he was fighting, serious court cases to try and get himself out of this financial mess. So really it was Leon Causton's and Joe Agresta and Nigel Blackiston that were looking after the stable. And they were building, we did touch on the fact they only had three horses, but they were building up the numbers. And they got him going. And they got the horse going. They got him to win a couple of races. And then that's, I think, when they started to find out that he actually had some ability. But being a horse, a bull, he did have a few issues as well, and they had to deal with those as well. It was between the ears, he wasn't the easiest horse to handle, and that became part of the mantra of getting him right, of being able to, figure him out a little bit. And then when Bart got him a little bit deeper into that spring preparation, that's when he thought that he was too fat. And they started to work him. And that's the theme that comes through. If you read Les Carline's book on Bart, the chapters are all the same. Between Derby Day and Melbourne Cup Day, Bart works the horses. And the theory is if they can't stand up to the work, they can't win the race. And that goes back as far as Lightfingers all the way through to Viewed. And that was wasn't his secret because it was there for everyone to see. But Bart was the one who had the courage to do it, to gallop horses on a Monday and even worked them on the Melbourne Cup morning before the race.
Sam, another major element of Kingston Rule and his success is, of course, his jockey, Darren Beedman. And Darren spoke very fondly about the colours he was wearing and that this horse did put him on the map to a degree and also the pin-up horse. Let's take a listen.
Kingston Rule colours, very famous Australian colours, the David Haynes colours, Kingston Town. Like he was the headline horse, he was the pin-up horse of my career when I first started. I remember seeing him at the track and so those colours are really dominant in racing at that stage of my career.
Sam, it seems like Beedman and Bart both had hay fever.
They did. Yeah, that it was really touching to see Darren reflecting 30 years later how big the Melbourne Cup is. Because at that stage, Darren, I think, was 23. He hadn't really come to Melbourne that much. He had won the Caulfield Guineas the year prior, I think, on Procol Harum. And that was sort of his first sort of foray into Melbourne. And the key was the fact that Jimmy Cassidy had knocked back the ride on Kingston Rule. Michael Clark had knocked back the ride on Kingston Rule from the Moonee Valley Cup. And they wanted a rider to ride him on Derby Day in the Dalgety and in the Melbourne Cup. And I think Darren, from memory, had ridden five winners in Sydney on the Saturday before on Moonee Valley Cup Day. And Anthony Cummings was the one who suggested to get Darren on board. And it was a great move for Darren. And he actually suited the horse really well because he rode on a long rein, which suited him. He didn't want to have a rider who could fight him. And he rode a little bit longer in his irons as well. He probably down, you know, at the time, you know, I think Shane Dye was the most popular rider of the time, and he had his knees underneath his chin. He was riding that short. And I think Darren's style suited the horse as well. And, of course, he listened to Bart's instructions, you know, hit him like you're going to hit me. I think that was the most relevant piece of information that Bart could give him before his first ride on him in the Dalgety.
Absolutely. Sam, the doco is easily found on various Twitter handles and on the racing.com website, and anyone who hasn't seen it has to see it because it's just so beautifully done. And it's not a glaringly obvious story, so it's very educational as well. What's the next project?
Well, I really like to do something with Harry White. I know Harry doesn't do a lot, and I know he hasn't been in the best of health, but I'd love to sit down with Harry White and just let him talk, to be honest. So if anyone knows that I can get in contact with Harry, I would love to have a chat to him. But the other one I'm sort of keen to try and see if I could get up is a really nice story, I think, with Craig Newitt for the autumn, where on one Saturday he unfortunately lost his father in a car accident and came out and finished second in the Futurity Stakes, and then 7 days later won the Group 1 Australian Guineas on Heart of Dreams.
And Light Fantastic was going around at that time too, wasn't he?
He rode Heart of Dreams in the Futurity and just got beaten by Nick Nero. And I think there's a really lovely story in that 7 day period about the focus that jockeys have, the support that they have, and the competitiveness that they have. And if I could convince Craig Newitt to do it, I'd love to sit down and do a story there.
Oh, I'm sure he'd be up for it, Froggy. Sam, you're doing a great job. You're bringing to life things that others aren't necessarily in racing. So keep up the good work, and well done with the Kingston Rule Doco, and look forward to the next one.
Thanks, Matt, Simona, Dan. It was great to be on talking to you.
Dan and Matt, what a fabulous insight into Kingston Rule with Sam Doran there. But the thing that stuck out to me very early on in that doco is the silks that the jockeys used to wear. And you look at Darren Beedman, who's absolutely waif-like and had that red and yellow tight lycra-type suit on. They didn't wear safety vests. It was just so, there was nothing left to the imagination and absolutely no body fat at all. Whereas today, they have that, the silks, don't they, a lot baggier, and they have those safety vests underneath too, I think.
Are you suggesting that Darren Beedman today wouldn't quite pull it off the same way that he did back then in the tight lycra?
Well, I'm sure 30 years ago I probably would have looked better in lycra too. So
yeah, no, that's,
there
well,
go.
There's probably some evidence of that as well. So, hey, guys, one of the most pleasing Derby winners for me, because I backed it, was Polanski, and a mate of mine trained it, and it was all a lovely story. And it was back in 2013. We're going to have a listen to Polanski, and then we're going to have a chat to the great Robert E. Lang, the former trainer of Polanski.
Polanski race to the lead. G's got there early. Here comes Complacent Criterion, and further back is Thunder Fantasy, and down the outside was Drago. Polanski in front, Complacent a length and a half away, then Criterion and Thunder Fantasy boxing on, but Polanski out in front and going strongly. He's two lengths in front of Complacent, and Polanski is too good for them in the Derby. Runs away a big staying win, and he wins it by three lengths. Complacent second, Thunder Fantasy's run.
Obviously
third.
In recent times, things haven't gone so well for Rob, and we're going to ask him about building back at the end of the interview. But that was a lovely moment in time there with Polanski. And as we introduce Robbie, how are you, Rob?
Very well, thank you, Matt.
You know, the thing that got me that year was how calm and serene you were after that win. It was almost like you expected it so much that it wasn't, there wasn't a massive wow factor on the day, even though there were 100,000 people there, because you just thought he'd do it, didn't you, Polanski?
Yeah, he'd
won the UCI, let go a long way from home and won, and then he won the Norman Robinson, not by a big margin, but Huey said won with authority, and he just blossomed after that. Aaron Lynch wrote him in all his work, and we did something a little bit different with him race morning, and we trotted around to the 600 on the grass and then just cantered back to where you leave the track, and his sparks were coming off his racing place. I said to Lynch, I said, what do you think? He said, won't get beat. When I went home, Kenny Corum was part owner from Winning Post, and he said, oh, any changes from last night? Because the night before I did an update, and I said, couldn't have him any better. I think the horse can win. And I said, all you got to worry about is the margin.
Oh, that's just such a shocking early crow, but you got away with it.
Greg Miles' call, Robbie sort of said that he's got there early, but it just added to the dominance of his win that day and backed up your confidence.
Yeah, it did. I mean, some of the derbies in recent years have been lacked a little bit, but when you beat Complacent and Criterion, Thunder Fantasy, or Group 1 winners afterwards, and beat them with authority, it's sort of no surprise that the night after the derby, he was 14-1 favourite for the following year's Melbourne Cup.
No, and it all went a bit pear-shaped in the autumn. But take us back to the start, Robbie. He was a son of Ratke. The Ratkes were rats. They were, you know, they weren't popular, and they were angry horses, and people couldn't train them properly, and all that sort of stuff. But you picked him up cheaply. You had a bit of a feeling about him at the yearling sales, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, racing, the world of racing has come so much closer to all of us because we can watch Royal Ascot and wherever you want to watch, really, and it was through the era of Elvstrom, and we were up to watch Elvstrom, and we seen this rat of a thing jacking up and trying to be coached to the barriers, and a horse called Racty, and I thought, oh, Elvstrom will beat it. Look at the attitude. Well, I never seen which way Racty went. It bolted in. He'd won about 5 Group 1, so he was a superstar racehorse. And I think the testosterone that he carried, he wanted to be boss. He didn't want to be bossed around by humans. And he treated his opposition with contempt during the races. So he comes over here. We all knew he was a highly spirited horse. And I wanted to buy his early 3 or 4 crops, colts, but they were too expensive. But I did notice when they got to the races, 18 months, 2 years later, they went from powerful, big, beautiful yearlings at the sales to really bone bags, ewe necks, horrible-looking things. And then I heard Racky died, so the old man's been telling me for 50 years, when a stallion dies, I'll always get a good one. So I said, oh, maybe Racky will get a good one. I should get one and leave it an entire, even though it might only race in 0 to 58, but just want to experiment and see if that testosterone was necessary in one of his sons. Just leave one of his sons an entire, and we broke him in. He was a bit toey, not too bad. And I bought a colt in New Zealand, and he did all his work with a horse called Dark Thunder. We paid $180 for him, a pen tire related to Denise's Joy. And I thought, that's lovely. The two of them can work together and do their derby preps together. And Dark Thunder actually had the better of him early, but he succumbed to a knee injury. He started a favourite in the Derby Trial Stakes and went to the paddock, and Kalinski just blossomed. I can remember I was hosing him about Christmas, which was 10 months before the derby. And I was just sort of standing back at the end of the hose, looking at him, admiring him. And God bless him, Ray Cleaver walked past, and I seen him looking at him and then looked back at him. I said, what are you looking at, Cleaver? He goes, not a bad type. And I said, should be. 200,000 buys a beer. He goes, well, you can tell why. I said, that's why Racky, it cost $4,000. He goes, oh, well, it'll die a maiden. And I remember that I got home from track work that morning, and I spoke to Jack Fraser, great friend of mine. He passed away way too young at 57. Jack said, how's that big Racky horse going? I said, oh, he's a derby colt. He goes, oh, really? You're only saying that. And I said, oh, geez, I like him. I said, he's developed into a magnificent big 2-year-old colt. Yeah, so he had 5 runs as a 2-year-old. Four runs as a 2-year-old, won twice at Caulfield, and then he had a foot problem. He ran in the Dane Hill a bit mad fresh, beaten 2.5, knocked arm overhead in the stakes, but then won the UCI, won the Norman Robinson, won the Derby, so won three out of five as a three-year-old.
Your $4,000 was looking pretty good at that stage, wasn't it?
It was looking really good when a week after the Derby, Tim Bredmore came out and had a look at me at Spelling Paddock, and he was talking, I don't know which Arab Sheik he had in tow, but we were sort of talking $5, $6 million for the horse to go and race overseas.
I did read an article on Polanski, Robbie, that said he was very profitable for punters. If they backed him throughout their career, they would have had a 355% return on their investment. So not only were you the one getting a return on your $4,000 investment, but the punters as well.
Yeah. Well, I started to exude confidence in him like a month before. And after he won the UCI, the foot problem that troubled him in the Danehill had abated. And I had another horse, a few blokes that were in Polanski called Hannaford. And I said to the manager of Polanski, Ross Warner, great ex-Richmond player, I said, Hannaford will win today at Mornington. He said, I might have a decent bet on him. He's paying well. And he won. And he said, and can Polanski win the Norman Robinson? I said, yeah, won't get beat. And I think he went all up, and just about all up again into the Derby.
Really?
Any sling for Robbie? Or
the best ever. Best ever.
Oh,
best ever to me, best ever to Aaron Lynch. Aaron Lynch, he might as well have rode it, the way Ross looked after him and looked after all the staff, right down to the muckaratas.
Oh, good on Roscoe for being a good slinger. And then the story, you know, I remember you and I spoke a lot about Polanski coming back, and he won a trial impressively, and he was... you know, I think he was shaping as an old-style Australasian superstar, say. He was going to be the next Rising Fast, but then he went amiss. And then because of his pedigree, Rob, he was not automatically easy to place at stud, was he?
No, it was very racky. Didn't haunt him through his racing career, but it did when we pulled up stumps with him. No one wanted to stand him. So the vet who looked after him through his career, Jackie McGregor, she stood him at... her place, and it's a boutique stud down on the peninsula, so he doesn't get a lot of mares, but he's getting he's got a few. Mr. Polanski goes good. Gennady looked like being as good as his dad, and I haven't seen him for 12 months, but he's been a bit disappointing. The other big horse won the Targ Rossi, Fabulanski, but he went to the Spelling Paddock, and unfortunately for him, he's become a gelding, so don't know whether that goes with the family policy.
Rob, you had a terrific time. You were getting horses to win feature jumps races first up. You're getting colts like Polanski winning Group 1 races. And the two-year-olds that you had, particularly Flemington, I remember fondly, I reckon you had at least four debutants win down the straight during Cup Week, sort of all around that period, 08 to about 2012-13. It must have been a, you know, to have the balance of young horses... good stayers and jumpers, you must have been in your glee.
Yeah, well, you know, because you've sort of been at it. I started training in 1980 and I was fourth on the trainers' premiership in Melbourne in 1990 when I was 30. And, you know, predictions were that I might have become a good trainer. But I've looked back on my career only recently and you've got to keep reinventing yourself as far as to your owner base, because in the mid-80s, like when I had Perfect Bliss in 83, great group of owners, I mean, Graham Werner with Cindy's Appeal and those horses in the mid-80s, but all of a sudden, you've been training 30 years, and those people might have been mid-50s when they were enjoying racing, all of a sudden they're 85, 90 or no longer with us, so you've really got to keep attracting a different group of people, and in the last 10 years or so, I've struggled with the sales. I used to buy 20 yearlings. The year Polanski won the Derby, I think I bought four. Direct Charge, he's one of the ones that went over the Cup Week. He won the Maribyrnong Plate. Direct Charge, Dark Thunder, Polanski, and there was one other. There was one that I bred, the same age as those three horses, was Lord of the Sky. And as you know, he was brilliant. He won over $1 million for us, and touched off by Shitaka and the TJ Smith. That would have been a big difference.
Would have been massive at the time. And just quickly, Rob, because we have run out of time. Obviously, through hard times, no licence in recent times, but you're hoping to meet with Racing Victoria soon to try and rekindle your career?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the thing that I've got going for me is I've never been suspended, never been disqualified, and financial reasons are the yelling going to tell me what hoops they need me to jump through, and I'll be attempting to tell them how I'm going to achieve it. So hopefully, I've done nearly 12 months now, so I've had a longer suspension than some of the bad guys.
Well, it's just call it a freshen up. Hey, Rob, good on you. Lovely to go back down memory lane, and you're a survivor. You'll be back. So thanks very much for your time this morning, and fingers crossed when you do try and take those steps out of the trouble of the last 12 months. But thanks for joining us on Cracking the Codes.
No worries. See ya.
Well, we could talk forever to Robbie Lang, and we do wish him well because he's such a great character and a terrific trainer, and it was great to revisit Polanski. Guys, we've come to an end again, and we're going to be right in the midst of Cup Week next week, so we're going to bang out another show, and it's going to be fantastic. The weather's warming up. It's going to be great.
Looking forward to it.
See you next week.
See you next week.